station promise outstanding content, but when it's time to deliver, they fall flat on their ridiculous faces. Enter LA Talk Radio, a cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk station that delivers totally original content without any commercials. Log on to latalkradio.com and get involved with the best talk radio station on the internet. LA Talk Radio, we say what we want.
The morning show that's on your side. But then again, so is appendicitis.
Get ready for the most popular morning show anywhere on the internet. You're listening to Sam in the Morning with Mia right here on LA Talk Radio. If you'd like to take part in the show today, give us a call at 323-203-0815. And now your program hosts, Sam and Mia.
Good morning and welcome back. It's July 23rd and we're back.
Yes, we are. Happy Tuesday.
Yes.
I think it's Tuesday, right?
It is Tuesday, okay, yeah. We're back in the middle of the week. What the heck, you know?
Yeah. Which is, I could still actually ask you now, how was your weekend?
Oh, my weekend, yeah.
This is like our Monday today.
That's true, exactly. If it was Thursday, you could still ask me about my weekend, you know? My weekend was nice, but yours was probably nicer. You went to Vegas, I saw.
I did.
Yeah,
was that kind of
a last minute thing or something?
It was so last minute.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
I mean, literally, I'm just hanging out all day, like at home, whatever, like cruising through Facebook, and I see that my friend has checked in to Vegas, and I'm like, what? You know, and I haven't seen them in like a year, you know, because they live like out of town and stuff, you know. So I'm like, oh my gosh, are you seriously in Vegas right now? Like, yeah, we're in Vegas. I'm like, that's so close to me. Hello, I live in LA. Like, you know, I'm like, well, come on down. I'm like, okay.
So
I jumped
from
on a
another
flight
place?
And
Oh, okay.
And I jumped on a flight and
flew
out there.
What a cool you know, instinctual thing to do, you know? It's just like you're wow, you know, let
for
me
sure.
join him for the weekend. That's cool. I like that. I like spontaneous things, you know?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And,
yeah.
You know, Nikki, you know, my roommate.
Oh, Nikki went with you?
Too,
oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, it was good. It was fun.
Yeah, so did you go to, like, pool parties and things like that?
We didn't do it. Well, by the time I got there, it was like super late on Friday night. And then Saturday, we just kind of had like a chill pool day because I'm like, oof, I'm not about to go to Wet Republic again. I'm like, you know, just getting there so late. I was still so like disoriented. So I was like, I think we'll just, you know, relax. And then, but then the next night, every night we went to Hakkasan.
Hakkasan, what's that? Like a club? A nightclub?
Yeah, we stayed at MGM again.
Oh, okay.
It's just so funny. Like, I still feel like I haven't really explored Vegas. Because every time I've gone, I've just stayed at MGM the whole time.
Yeah.
But I will say, we actually, we went over to the Wynn, and we saw a show.
Yeah.
It was called Le Rev.
You saw Le Rev?
I did.
Isn't that amazing?
It's like a half water show, half, like, land, half acrobatics in the air. Like, it was just... Oh my gosh!
And the stage is amazing.
Mind blowing. Yes.
Yeah.
So colorful.
Right.
So beautiful.
And the story is nice too. Did you get the story? It's sort of hard to get it, but afterwards somebody told me, so I kind of got it. Although I forgot by now.
So you saw it?
Oh yeah, I saw it.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah,
you know
we were standing at the Encore. They have nice suites there and stuff. So that was about a year ago, I think. And yeah, so you liked it a lot.
I loved it.
Yeah. It's with all the water and stuff. And do you believe how far up they jump from? I mean, isn't that like
amazing?
That was
probably one of my favorite parts. Yeah. When they just take them all the way up. And
I know.
Boom, just drop them straight down.
I don't know how these people can do it, you know? It's
amazing.
And
everything was so synchronized.
Right.
Like, how do you get it that dead on every single show, every time?
Yeah, yeah.
Just so, oh my gosh, so much talent.
Yeah, that's the thing. And this one is not a Cirque du Soleil from what I understand.
It's not?
I don't think it is.
Huh.
Yeah. Did you see any Cirque du Soleil on the signs there? I don't think I saw them, you know?
No.
But at any rate, we can check into that. But somebody told me it wasn't part of Cirque du Soleil, so...
Oh, well, it seemed very Cirque du Soleil-esque.
Yeah, it's very similar, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's good. So you had fun there and stuff, and was it really hot?
Oh, in Vegas. When we were laying out by the pool, oh, my gosh, I was struggling.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, because I wasn't really wanting to, like, get in the water or anything. You know, at that point, I was just kind of like, I'm just going
to
lay out.
But it's hard to
lay
out in the sun out there, you know?
Yeah, I was like, I need some shade now. It is really hot.
Yeah. That's
but,
cool.
Yeah.
Well, at least it was safe for you. Did you hear about this woman that fell off a roller coaster in Texas?
What?
Yeah.
No. Oh,
and
no.
You just went to a theme park, didn't you?
Yeah. Wait. How did she?
She was on a roller coaster and she just fell and died.
Oh.
Yeah. Isn't that pretty scary?
Ouch.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's. And, I mean, do you know if it was, did like the harness break or did she do something?
I don't
or
know.
Like how does?
I don't know what happened, man. I don't know. I didn't really look into it.
Oh man.
But it was about a drop of 147 feet.
Oh.
Yeah.
God, that's terrible.
I know, I know. They're saying she, well, falling out of her seat. That's what they said, you know. So I don't know how that's possible, but it did happen.
Oh, and that was in Texas?
Yeah.
Ugh.
I know. Isn't that scary? I mean, that's every person's, like, nightmare when you go to a theme park or something.
Oh,
know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, that was pretty bad. Are you excited about the royal baby?
Oh, my gosh, yes!
It's like, you know, I mean, all of Facebook is full with that. And after a while, it's like, okay, we got it.
Yeah.
You know? We got enough of that, you know.
Yeah, it's a baby.
Yeah.
It happens. Two people get together and people have babies.
Yeah, so it's royal. He
it
could
just so
be
happens
a king
to be royal.
One day. Yeah, you know. He could be the king one day. But still, you know, I mean, they're overdoing it a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, any reason to celebrate is good, I guess.
Yeah, it's just interesting how something like that become such a big part of social media.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, they're all, you know, up in the tabloids with all the A-listers,
right.
You know, and you're reading these, like, People magazines and everything. It's like they also are now including, like, you know, the president's life and, you know, royalty's life. And it's like, okay.
Yeah, yeah. People are fascinated with it, you know. I mean, I think even our celebrities here, we like them because they're a royalty, you know. I mean, we don't have a king and a queen.
Right.
So
that's very true.
So we get some other stars to celebrate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool.
Yeah.
And so you're back in one piece, and that's important. And
yeah.
Good.
Somehow. It's just.
I see
it's
you didn't get burned from
like
the sun either. Do you put like a lot of suntan?
I put a little bit on, but thankfully, I think it might be the Italian in me. I have like that kind of olive skin tone. You know?
Right.
So knock on wood.
But you would still get
really,
a tan.
I don't really burn.
Yeah, you don't get burned, but you get a tan and stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I like personally, I try to stay out of the sun.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a good idea.
Save my skin. So yeah, after
right.
I was feeling the heat for a little while, I'm like, okay. I'm
going to
go in the shade now.
Cool. Well, sounds good to me.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, we're going to skip a lot of the news today because we have a very special guest in the studio, and we're going to bring him in. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Dave Newmark from Bid for Spots. And so welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you, Sam.
Yes, and you're local, which is cool, so you were able to come into the studio. And have you lived in L.A. all your life?
I have, except when I went to college.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Stanford University, where I met my wife, Patty.
Oh, really?
That's right.
Stanford is outside of San Francisco, right?
That's right, Palo Alto, California.
Yeah. So that's where all the high tech and everything starts, pretty much.
You know, at the time that I was there, it was before the internet boom. The biggest tech company was Hewlett Packard.
Mm.
And the town has changed tremendously due to the internet and
it has.
Venture capital.
Right.
Yeah.
I know. I went to the, you know what was interesting there? I went to the Computer Museum in San Jose. And it's just, you know, so that's in the heart of Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just amazing the evolution of computers and technology and so forth, you know. And you were talking about HP. They showed some of their really old computers and things like that.
Oh,
so it's
wow.
really cool. Yeah. That's
so
where everything comes from. That
yeah, it used
we're
to be like an entire room would be like one computer.
Right.
Just all this technological
right.
looking
and
stuff.
Today,
that's
today
way
our,
over my head.
Yeah. And our iPhone today is more powerful than those computers, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Which is amazing. We carry it in our hand. So this is cool. So, I mean, it's no surprise you came from a good school and then you started a nice company and everything.
Well, thank you, Sam. You know, I think you're talking about HP and about California schools and so forth. And I'm thinking about the fact that at a place like Stanford, I think one of the reasons, in addition to the fact that there's that culture of innovation with technology, it's also a place where ideas can flourish and people don't have to be afraid to fail.
Mm.
And I think that maybe the confluence of my being in the ad business and looking at some of the challenges that advertisers faced and radio stations faced, and then my background at not being afraid to fail and not being afraid of technology, it just kind of all came together and bid for spots.
Great. And now, I know from Stanford, a lot of entrepreneurs came from there, right? I mean, Larry Page and the Google guys and I think the Yahoo people, and a lot of people came from there. And yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating school for me. So you're very fortunate to go there. You must have had good grades, obviously, in school.
Well, I actually graduated with a degree in human biology.
Uh-huh.
And
that
actually kind of informed my sense of processes, because mm-hmm. biological processes are in many ways machine-like and fascinating and complex.
Mm-hmm.
But I also studied public policy as it related to environmental issues and so forth. So I really kind of had a wide-ranging liberal arts, experience. But I think that in a way I have the advantage of not having come through the Stanford system at the time when a lot of the technology entrepreneurs came in with venture capital getting funded for just every idea under the sun. I come from a background of having run an ad business and having to, make sure that payroll gets met and not have to worry about whether investors are hot or cold and just make sure that it works for buyers and sellers. And so I think that that's something that in a way gives me an advantage, because the people who are just looking at the technology side don't understand that when you have a marketplace like an ad exchange, you have to have a win-win situation.
Right.
Buyers have to win and sellers have to win. And
right.
so you have to take into consideration psychology and marketplace dynamics that are outside of technology.
Right, that's true. And but it's known as a good business school as well, right? I mean, it gives you background and so forth. So you grew up here in LA, and so what did you do before college? I mean, did you already do anything? It was just straight high school?
Yeah, straight high school. I actually loved politics, and I got involved in politics at Beverly Hills High School. I actually was the president of Beverly Hills High School.
Wow.
And I think that my love of radio came from there, because at the time, the school presidents had all promised that someday there would be a school radio station.
Mm.
And radio station was a loosely defined term because it really meant that there was a cable station in the Beverly Hills local area.
Right.
It might have been Century Cable or whatever it was at the time. But anyway, the point is that there would be a station at the school that would be run by students and so forth. And I was able to get the Board of Education to appropriate the money, and it was built by the students and run and launched during my
term. You made it happen.
I made it happen.
Wow.
And so
uh-huh.
I think it was maybe built into my DNA that and even way back before then, in junior high school, there was a long teacher's strike, and I was in this speech class. I remember it well, because there was homeroom in the junior high school, and I was the PA announcer during homeroom. And because of this teacher's strike, there was not the normal rotation of students in that speech class to do that job. So I ended up doing that job for months and months on end, and I think it got me into the idea of audio, the power of audio.
Right. That's cool. Now, as a teenager, you said you enjoyed radio and stuff. What were you listening to talk radio already, or were you listening more to music and the DJs? And
well, being 56 years old, I actually am old enough that this was before FM really got kicked into gear. So
right.
AM stations were really the leading stations when I was growing up. KHJ, for example, was a very strong music station.
Mm-hmm.
Boss Radio.
Yeah.
And then during my later teen years, KNX FM was really the place.
KNX FM was amazing. This was a station, Mia, back in the 90s, right? Or 80s, I'm sorry.
It's actually the 70s, the late 70s.
Late 70s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, early 80s, I remember. You're right. And I remember when the station was started, it was amazing, but they had music that you couldn't find anywhere else. It was album music, more artists that are great, but you never heard of them before.
Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills and Nash, James Taylor, Carole King, all of them.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So you see, I discovered the station little later, maybe because I only moved to L.A. in 1981, you know, but it probably existed before that.
Right.
Yeah. Wow, that's cool. So, yeah, we go way back, both of us, I think. Bio is just a glint in her parents' eyes.
But I think that, you know, what's fascinating to me today, Sam and Mia, is that radio is just as powerful today, if not more powerful, than it was then. And actually, I want to kind of refer to your Las Vegas trip a little bit, Mia, because, you know, when you were talking about that, you were telling a story. You talked about how you were just kind of hanging out at the house, and you were on Facebook, and then you found out your friends were in Vegas, so you went to Vegas, and then you went to that show, and you watched what was going on there, and then you were out by the pool, and it was a little hot, so you decided to come inside. Mm-hmm. All of that was probably painting a picture in listeners' minds as you were telling that story, and that's what I think the power of radio advertising can do. It's amazing.
That's true, yeah. So at what point, so you went to school, to college. Did you do anything with radio there?
No.
No, nothing. So you just went for human biology and that's...
And I thought I would be a lawyer. I thought I would go into a legal practice. And I actually went to the law library and I kind of hung out at the law school and all that. And I talked to lawyers, and when I delved into it, I realized that I loved the idea of studying law, but I didn't like what lawyers did very much.
Right,
so,
yeah. I don't blame you.
I thought I would go into business, and my path was that I would work for my dad, who at the time was running his own ad agency, and he has an interesting past, which I'll tell you in a minute, but I would learn the trade, so to speak, and my plan was I would go to work for one of his clients, and then I would, perhaps they would send me to business school and I would get a graduate degree in business, and then I would come back as maybe a vice president and sort of take it from there. And when I presented my father with that plan, I said, so I'd like to come to work for you for maybe a year or so and then, you know, do this little plan. He said, no.
Really?
And I said, what do you mean no? I'm your son. How can you say no to that plan? And he said, well, you know what? I can't teach you anything meaningful in 1 year. So, if you come to work for me for 3 years, I can teach you much more in depth and then do whatever you like.
Wow, that's very interesting. So in a year, you still can't learn
everything. No, and at the time, full-service advertising really meant that you had to learn everything there was. I had to not only write and produce for radio, I had to write and produce for television. I had to learn how to do a print run. I had to do 4-color separations, 5-color, 6-color separations on a printing press. I had to know how to supervise a print run. I had to choose the paper. I even had to learn how to do paste up.
Really?
Which is, setting the type. You know, today,
before desktop publishing.
Before desktop publishing, you had to actually send out to a company that had computers that would print out typographics, because at the time the only thing that that most businesses had were typewriters.
Right.
And so had to send out for type and then literally put. I'll take a brush, stick it in glue, this type of paste, I'm not kidding you, and then you paste on the back of it, cut it up, and then stick it with a T-square on the board, and then that would become the ad.
Right, exactly. I mean, even newspapers were laid out like that for credit.
So I had to learn all
like
of
so
that.
So much work.
Not to mention all of the aspects of business. But really, I fell in love with radio, and during the 80s, I became a ghostwriter for CBS Radio, and I started a program called The Marketing Partnership, where I would basically crank out commercials, and it would be presented by the local account executives at the radio stations, and I would just get a small commission. And that, that grew, but it never got me any national accounts, so I decided to drop that, and then from there go on to work on endorsement radio here in Los Angeles, and working with the likes of Michael Jackson and those who remember KBC had the Ken and Bob show and others.
This is a different Michael Jackson, not the one that you know, Mia. There was a Michael Jackson
I was
on the radio.
Like,
no, there was a Michael Jackson on radio.
But these were really powerful, influential radio hosts, and I brought some clients into it, and I always dreamed of being able to bring it onto a national stage, but basically I lacked two things. The first was that there was no way to be able to hear the spots right after they had aired in other parts of the country, because the internet really wasn't around at that time.
Right.
And well, it was, but it was only in scientific circles. Yeah. And so there was no way to be able to hear the spots unless someone sent a cassette tape by Federal Express or something, which would be ridiculous. And then the other problem was that there was no way to identify who the most influential radio hosts around the country were. So I solved the first problem, which had to do with transmitting sound over the internet when sound was on the internet, which was 1995. Mm-hmm. I invented some software called AirChecks Online that enabled stations to transmit over a file transfer protocol and enable our own staff and our clients to be able to listen password protected. So that part was fine.
Right.
But it wasn't. But the second problem was much more difficult to solve, which is to identify the most influential radio hosts. And for that, I brought my psychology wife, I say psychology because she studies psychology with me at Stanford. Well, she was with me at Stanford, but she studied psychology. I studied human bio. Anyway, so she was able to research the influential aspects of radio hosts around the country and took about 2.5 years to do it. And by 98, said, okay, I'm ready. I have my list and I'm ready to go. And off we went.
Right. So how did how did she do that now?
She listened to thousands of hours of radio personalities around the country on cassette tapes.
Oh, my gosh.
Seriously. And and she picked incredible winners. And that endorsement radio program became the agency. My dad retired. He's still working today, by the way. He has a little office, and and he does a little bit of advertising with a couple of clients, and he's doing great. But Newmark Advertising really became solely focused on endorsement radio, and she still runs that company today, and it's growing and very, very successful. And so I did it with her from about that time, 98, until about 2004, when one of our clients asked, you know, Dave, it seems like there ought to be an easier, scalable way to be able to find discounted rates on radio stations that have unsold inventory. Why isn't there one of those ways to do that?
Right. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you were just using radio as a vehicle for advertising. You weren't that involved with it as far as production and research and all
that.
No,
not at all, Sam. I was actually doing just the endorsement radio with my wife, Patty. She was mostly running the business and managing it and finding the hosts and so forth, and I was working on the creative side, coming up with copy outlines and things like that. No, there was no involvement in the produced side of radio at all. So when this client asked about it, isn't there a way to be able to find these last-minute deals and so forth, I said, well, not really. I said, there's a few companies out there that sort of nip at the edges of the thing, but no, there isn't a broad way to do it.
And you're talking about smaller businesses and stuff, because obviously the big companies, they go through the advertising agency and they know how to get through to the radio stations, right?
Right. That's a very good point, Sam. Actually, just to give you guys a few numbers to give you a sense of how powerful radio is, about 240 million people listen to the radio on 11,000 radio stations. Now, 80% of the money, about $17 billion that goes into the business today, is done, 80% of it is done by local businesses in each of those local cities. So although it sounds like incredibly massive, actually the vast majority of the business is done local station to local advertiser. It might be a local mattress store, a local car dealer, and so forth. And those, it's a manageable thing for those advertisers because they know the stations they want to be on, and they can work with the sales reps to come up with promotions and special events and all that kind of thing. So that's great. And then large advertisers can buy network programs such as sports programming or talk program or even music shows. But to your point, Sam, the small to medium-sized business that is national, such as maybe a dating service or a company that sells products on the online or on the internet, or let's say with direct response with a phone number, they are able to do Facebook and some social media, and they can do some Google search advertising and so forth. But when it comes to radio, the notion of trying to find deals on any number of 11,000 radio stations is just overwhelming, and so they don't
do it. And the interesting thing is, I remember Google was trying to play around with this a little bit, but it didn't last.
No, it's a great point. They came up with a program called, they bought a company in 2006 called DMARC, Mm-hmm. And then they were trying to transition that into a company called Google Audio. And mm-hmm. and the idea behind it was that they would buy the systems that were running the station so that they could mm-hmm. see what was unsold and then simply transact it. I think what they got wrong is that they just had it backwards. They were having a forward auction in which the buyer bids and the highest price wins, when what I was doing was having the sellers bid and the lowest price wins.
Oh, I see. Okay. So so this is when the idea came about, right? When you when the person asked you about this and you said, no, there's no way to do this now.
Well, it came about in two stages. The mm-hmm. the first was when he asked the question, I started talking to... the first part of it was just understanding what the problem was, and the fact is that radio stations do have a problem, selling last minute inventory because they don't want to have a fire sale. And so I thought, well, that seems like a real tough thing for the stations. I mean, they've got perfectly good stations that are reaching millions and millions of listeners, and yet, you know, the advertisers aren't being able to get deals. And so it's kind of like two camps in the forest that can't find each other.
Right.
And it just seemed to me like that was such an intractable problem. And so the first thing that happened was I thought I was watching my son actually online one night buying something on eBay. And I remember exactly where I was. I was standing in the doorway of his room and he was watching him buy something. And the light bulb went off and I thought, wow. Auction. I'll do an online auction. Then the next morning, I started calling some of the radio station people that I know from the business, and they all said, well, Dave, actually, some companies had done that in the dot-com boom days. By the way, this was 2004, just for context. And right. So in the dot-com boom days, those companies were huge, AdAuction.com, eMadison, and others. They had hundreds of millions of dollars of investor money. By 2004, they were gone. I mean, vaporized.
Really?
So I realized there was something wrong with auctions. Okay, so that wasn't going to work. So I thought about it and thought about it, and one day I was talking with a programmer friend of mine, and we were talking about supply and demand, and then I got the second light bulb moment, and I realized, oh my gosh, I think I know what everybody got wrong. It was one simple thing. They just had it backwards. All of them were doing forward auctions where the advertisers would bid against each other and the highest price would get the inventory. But when you have high supply and low demand, which happens at the last minute, you should flip it. You should have the seller's bid and the lowest price wins, not the buyer's bid and the highest price wins.
Yeah.
So it was those two ideas in combination, the fact that it would be an auction, and then the second being that it should be a reverse auction.
Wow. Huh. Now, at that point, were you concerned with the technical part of it at all, or were you thinking, eventually I'll find the people that can do this for me?
You know, Sam, that was surprisingly easy. I contracted with a company that helped me to build the site. And because I have so much background in the ad business, I was able to come up with the rules of the game.
Mm.
And one of those rules actually turned out to have to do with confidentiality. And this is where, you know, going back to your original question about Stanford University and about the technology companies and all that, and how they've been so successful, and why I feel so fortunate that I did not come from that time. Because most of the people in ad exchanges feel that complete transparency is what they need to do. That is to say, complete openness about all the rates and everything. But I knew that when these stations would bid low, if we revealed the spot rates, it would destroy the marketplace.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Because if these spot rates would be revealed and they were much, much lower than their published rates, everybody would stop buying the regular way and they would only come through us. And I knew that in order to preserve rate integrity, we would need to keep that secret. So we reveal everything else about the buy except the spot rate, and by keeping that one piece of information confidential, it gives them safety to be able to bid.
Wow, very clever.
Thank
very
you.
Very clever. So you found a company that would do this for you. And did you have the financial resources, or did you have to go to investors? And
well,
something like that is pretty, I mean, it requires a lot of money, obviously. It's not like opening up a restaurant.
Yes, I've been able to have the support of my family money and the other agency to be able to support it over the years. And that that freedom of having that financial support has enabled us to weather not only competition, which all of them are, all the marketplaces that came up after Google, there were several others, are all gone today.
Really?
But it also allowed us to weather the recession. And I'm very, very optimistic about what's ahead of us, because as the economy picks up, these small to medium-sized businesses that are starting to emerge are feeling much more optimistic, and they'll be able to start really growing their businesses and ours as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. So, yeah, you're given, and that's what I like about the internet, you know, it's given, or not just the internet, but technology since the PC came out, and that is empowering individuals, you know.
Yeah. And yeah, like what you said earlier, people are afraid to fail.
That's right.
You know, so I feel like, with the internet, it's, you know, you're behind a computer. It's not like you're out there personally putting yourself out there. Of course, yeah, networking has a lot to do with it too, but with creating a business, you know, it's, you can be, you know, kind of silent with the whole thing. If you don't want your name necessarily out there, you can do it without, you know, being...
You know, that's a very good point, Mia, and I'd like to expand on that for a minute because I think that a lot of people are afraid to fail, but small to medium-sized businesses are especially afraid because their resources are so thin, and they, they feel like, oh my gosh, if I make a big mistake, I'm gonna, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. When it comes to radio, I think most businesses understand that it's a storytelling medium and that it's powerful and reaches a lot of people, but the idea of trying to negotiate is just so scary.
Right.
And so the idea that there would be a marketplace where they simply put in their spot, they put in their money, and our staff, by the way, holds their hand through the entire process.
Oh, really?
They don't have to do anything. We tell them everything to do.
Wow.
And so they're not afraid anymore.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, so you deal with local as well as in as national.
Most
stations.
Of our advertisers are national, but small to medium-sized businesses.
I see. Okay. So so now, would this work for a local business too?
Certainly.
Yeah.
We have some businesses in New York who use us. Some in Los Angeles. You know, and actually, we have a law firm that has been using us every single week for since about December of last year in Minneapolis. So yeah, we have you know, a wide range of businesses, everything from Fortune 500 companies down to a two-man band.
Right. Now, let me ask you this: is this any of your concern? Because in the talk industry and stuff, I'm following it pretty much, and or radio in general. And people seem to be moving away from radio as far as listeners, you know, because now it's not only local, you know, first you have syndicated shows throughout the nation, and you also have satellite radio, you have internet radio, and most importantly, I think people that listen to music have moved away from radio and more to their iPods and iPhones and you know, and where they can play their own music.
Yeah, for sure, you know. For sure, 100%. Like, even when I started telling people, like, oh, yeah, you know, I do radio now, and they're like, oh, nobody listens to radio. I'm like, no, you don't understand. This is, like, different radio, not, like, music, you know, in the car, because nobody does that anymore. I'm like, no, this is, like, the future of radio.
Well, I think actually Mia is right that streaming audio and online and internet radio really is the future of radio. But what's interesting is that advertisers have to make sure that they spend their money wisely to reach consumers today.
Right.
And today, there's some really interesting numbers that I was found from the RAB, which is the Radio Advertising Bureau. I'll give you some of those numbers. In every single age cell, this would be from like 12 to 18, from 18 to 25, from 25 to 34, and so forth, all the way up to, you know, in people in their 80s, radio reaches about an average of 90% of those people in America, which turns out to be 242 million people that listen for on an average of more than 13 hours a week.
Really?
Really. Now, here's the thing where Mia's right. The growth, and both of you have said this, the growth in online radio is pretty staggering. It's like 33% a year, but it's a small absolute number. So the fact is that about 7% of all radio listening is done to online radio.
Right.
But that does leave 93% listening to old-fashioned over-the-air radio.
Obviously. Now, the thing is that, you know, because when I ask people and stuff like that, or from what I've seen, not many people listen to radio at home. You know, I mean, it's just not an appliance that people use anymore.
Right.
And so I would imagine people mostly listen in the car. And in the car, you can reach them maybe for 15, 20 minutes or so. And so where's the loyalty that they used to have to their radio shows?
Is that
still there?
Yeah, I think it is. And actually, Sam, I'm thrilled that you brought that up about the car, because I think that there's something magic about that. You know, what advertisers give up a little bit in targetability because they are not, let's say, buying a search term. For example, if they're a flower company and they're buying and they want to sell to people who are interested in flowers, they can go on Google and buy the term flowers, and then of course they're going to get people who are interested in flowers. So that's highly targetable.
Right.
Radio reaches a broad audience and so forth. But
what
an advertiser gives up in that targetability using a broadcast medium like radio, they get in the intensity of listening. So I'm just going to paint a picture for you for a moment and say that yes, it's true. So let's say for that, you know, 15-minute errand run or that 40-minute commute to work or home, you know, it's not all day. It's just during that time. But during that time, they are focused on the audio that they're hearing. And why is that? It's because their brain is gone into basically, I'm not going to get too biological here, but basically, when you're driving, you're mostly driving to a destination that you know. And so you don't really have to use high-level processing of your brain to do it. It's more habit. And when your brain is basically functioning on habit, it allows the more complex part of your brain to focus on more complex thoughts, which would be stories that you're hearing on the radio. Maybe that story is a song about a love lost, or maybe it's a, you know, political tirade by somebody who's on the air that you're listening to, or maybe it's a commercial and you're hearing the story about a business. So it's the intensity of that listening that's really magic. And so what I love about the power of radio is the ability to tell that story in such a captivating way.
I see. So even if you capture them for a short period of time, they're very focused on what's going on.
That's right.
Involved.
That's right.
Yeah. That makes sense. You know, I mean, that's an important thing. Now, so, by the way, we're talking to Dave Newmark from bitforspots.com. And this is a company that puts together businesses and radio stations. And now, do you guys actually work on the whole process, I mean, on each deal, or is it pretty much automated?
I'll tell you how it works. It's a weekly auction that takes place every Thursday from 8 a.m. to noon Pacific time. And it's separated, meaning that the advertisers have everything ready on Wednesday, which is three things. They have their commercial ready, which we can help them to write and produce. They have their money in, and then they have their invitations set in our system. And our staff helps with all of that. Mm. So three things, the spot, the money, and the invitation. That happens on Wednesday by noon Pacific time for the following week. Then the next morning, those stations that have been invited by those advertisers bid live in our system against each other, and those stations who bid with the lowest prices win the advertiser's money, and then 1 hour later, the system basically announces the winning stations and says to those stations, okay, go. Pick up the spot, pull it down from our site, and run it the next week.
Wow.
This is what happens every single week.
Right. Now, why is it on Wednesday? What's the reason for that?
You know, Sam, I back-timed it. This was actually kind of fun research. In order to figure out the rules of the game, I wanted to find out when would be the last possible minute we could have the auction end. Because I really wanted to give the stations the ability to sell their inventory at the regular prices as long as possible, giving them every chance possible so that when they came into the auction, they were confident that there was really no other choices.
Right.
And so I called around to many, many stations, and I found out that really the stations that had the slowest processes, because you have to work to the lowest common denominator, the stations that had the slowest processes were those on the East Coast that had maybe in the smallest markets, and they closed their books, close of business Thursday at 5 o'clock. And so they would, at 5 o'clock on a Friday, 5 o'clock on a Thursday was when they closed their books. So for the following week. So I figured, all right, I'm going to give them 1 hour to traffic the spots. So I had to have the thing end, basically be announced at 4, and so the auction would have to end at 3. So then I back-timed it, and I figured I'd make it a 4-hour auction because it's bid 4 spots, and I just thought the number 4 sounded good.
Yeah.
And so I made it go from 11 to 3 Eastern, which is 8 to noon Pacific.
Right.
And that really is pushing it to the end.
Right. Now, if somebody's interested in this, what kind of money are we talking about that's involved? I mean, obviously, there's a variety of stations, big difference in their audiences and so forth. But let's say I'm a small business, and I'd like to reach, let's say I launched a retail store on the website or something, or not a retail store, but a store on the web.
An e-commerce website.
Right. And I wanted to be able to advertise on the radio, let's say nationally. So, I mean, what's the give us an idea of what somebody would go through.
Right. What we have found is that the average auction size after which advertisers are happy, meaning the point at which we get a very high return rate, is about $2,000 a week.
Mm.
And you might think, well, how on earth could you spend $2,000 and be, you know, national? And the answer is easy. In our system, you might invite 2,000 radio stations to compete for your business,
right.
And clearly 2,000 radio stations are not going to win your $2,000. But those who do win will have had to fight for it.
Right. And it's because they, at that point, they don't have much to lose because they still have all that inventory to sell and so forth. And I think that's what your business is banking on the fact that they do have the unfilled inventory. And so at the last minute, they'll probably be able to, you know, to give it away for a lot less.
That's right, Sam. And there's another aspect of this, which I think is really important to note, which is that the stations feel comfortable and protected in the sense that we're not going to reveal the spot rates. So they can go down to sell their spots for, you know, a dollar when they normally sell for $50 and not have to worry about it. It's not going to get revealed. And the other aspect is that they're in full control. And I want to talk for a moment about that because they see the advertisers who have invited them. And if they see an advertiser there that maybe is already on the air that's paying full rate and they don't want to bid on that advertiser, they don't have to.
Right.
And also the stations don't sign any contracts with us. There's no commitment to bid. There's no demand or anything like that. If they want to bid, great. If they don't, that's fine too, which is another aspect of control because it might be that they're maybe 85 to 90% sold out and the sales manager and the program director say, you know what, let's not take any more advertising this week because we just want to have a few spots to give advertisers for bonus spots and we want to play more music and have higher ratings. So if they want to not bid that week because they're pretty close to sold out, they don't bid.
They don't have to.
No, and that control is something they really like.
Right. Hmm. Wow, that's pretty interesting. So so the stations compete with each other, but I would imagine once you accept the price, then you're committed to that, right? It's not like they can back out or anything like an eBay.
That's actually a really interesting question because there is a term called remnant advertising, and that has a technical definition, which is that the if you buy remnant advertising on radio, the stations can bump you, which is called the spots being preemptible, and the stations can run you pretty much any time of the day or night. We are not remnant, which means that the stations cannot bump the spots. If they win, they must run as aired, and they cannot run at any time of the day or night. They only run it when the advertiser has specified.
Right. Okay. Wow.
Yeah, so that's a very big deal.
Right. Now, when someone advertises, obviously, you know, a week is probably not enough. You know, you need a lot of repetition and so forth. What can someone expect as far as results from advertising on the radio?
You know, in order to answer that, I'm going to talk a little bit of marketing ease for your listeners who are interested in marketing. There's something called the adoption curve. And I think everybody, you know, they hear that term and they think, oh, my God, what is that? It sounds complicated. But it's actually pretty easy to understand. If you think about the kinds of people who stand in line at the Apple store when the newest iPhone comes out, they're called early adopters.
Right.
They're in right away. Like they just hear the message and boom, they're there. They're right in.
It doesn't matter what it is or anything.
No,
yeah,
they're first in line. Yeah. They want it and they want it now.
Right.
So when advertisers go on the air and they start to talk about their product or service, there are going to be early adopters, people who rush right in and they call right away or they click right away and they jump in and they buy. But they are relatively small in number. The biggest pool of consumers are called the late majority. They're called majority for a reason, that they are the biggest pool, and they're called late for a reason. They hang back. So they're hearing the message in the beginning, and they're hearing it again, and they're hearing it again, and they're hearing it again, but they don't act.
Right.
They only act later. It's not because they're cynical. It's just that they want to make sure that they feel good about making that act, taking that action.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so if you're an advertiser and you stop after 2 or 3 weeks, you'll get a little bit of action, but what you will have missed is that late majority.
Right, and that's true, you know, because I know And it's often because, you know, you might hear the commercial, but you don't need to use that service right away. But it stays in your head. You know, like you have those mattress places that drill everything into your head all the time repeatedly. So you might hear it for a few years. You don't need a mattress. But when you do, they're going to be top of mind for
That's
you.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Wow, this is very interesting. So tell people how they can get started, how they go about this and so forth.
Sure. If they go to our website, which is bidforspots.com, they can sign up and one of our national account managers will reach out to them. That's B as in boy, I, D as in David, the number 4, SPOTS.com. Right. We also have a toll-free number, which if you don't mind, I'll
go
give
ahead.
It. It's 866-326-7788, and our staff will get that as well and be able to help advertisers through. And we do understand the sensitivity that most of these advertisers have no background in radio advertising at all. They
right.
just have a product or service, and they want to tell a story, and they want that story to be told in the most compelling way. And we can help them get a spot created. It only costs about $550 to get a spot written and produced and voiced. And we can also set them up with telemarketing companies. We can also get them toll-free numbers. So we have a lot of ancillary services that we point them to so that they, right. they get their hand held through the whole process.
Right. So it's a one-stop place for all the solutions and everything.
Right, because we recognize that most of these companies have zero experience buying radio airtime.
Right, yeah. Right. Now, so someone who does have zero experience, what do they have to look for? I mean, I know people, the first thing that go is to how many listeners, you know, but I think there's also the quality of listeners, right? And their location and so forth. Do you help with that as well?
Yes, we do. There's a number of different aspects to making sure that your message gets on the right station and that you get the most value. The first is you want to make sure that you're targeting the right age demographic and gender demographic and market demographic. For example, you know, not all cities are the same. And so, you know, we have since you invite stations by market, it may be that, for example, your product would be best advertised in the South, or maybe in the Northeast, or maybe Pacific Northwest, or just the West Coast.
Right.
It might have
yeah.
to do with, like we have an advertiser that's going to be selling steaks, gourmet steaks, and their delivery costs are much less on the West Coast, so they're only advertising in West Coast stations. So
there are
all kinds of things that go into deciding which places to go.
Right.
And then you also have to think about, well, when is my product going to be most resonant with the listeners? Would it be in the morning drive? Would it be in the overnight? Maybe it's a sleeping aid or whatever, and so
right.
you want to do that. Or maybe it's something that has to do with, you know, education, and you're thinking about that first thing in the morning, so you go on the morning drive, you know, that kind of thing. We also have charities that use us, and they're actually having a lot of success on the weekends because there's actually, as a proportion of their total inventory, more unsold inventory on most stations on the weekends. And so the deals are exceptional there.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great. So when you bid, do you end up with only one station or a few stations?
A few stations.
A few stations.
Actually, it could be many stations, depending. You know, we have advertisers who spend $2,000 a week. We also have advertisers who have spent up to $200,000 a week. And so it's really a function of how many stations will be able to win based
right.
on the budget. But the competition is based on the cost to reach each 1,000 listeners. And this goes to your original
right.
question, Sam, about value and how do you know if you're reaching, you know, the right people at the right price kind of thing. And
right.
so that's why we base it on cost per 1,000 listeners. So only those stations with the lowest cost to reach each 1,000 listeners win the advertiser's money.
Right. Very good. Well, Dave Newmark from bidforspots.com. Go to bid4spots.com, and all the information is there. And like you said, there's people to hold your hand and help you in that, so you're not on your own. It's not like doing a Google AdWords campaign or something where it's all automated and stuff here.
That's
people
right.
actually are involved and stuff. So that's very interesting. Well, Dave, thank you so much for joining us. It's very exciting. And I always admire entrepreneurs that find solutions for people. And being in radio, I know that this is something that's definitely important, I think, to both radio stations and businesses and advertisers.
Well, it's my pleasure. And I want to thank you and Mia for giving me this opportunity to talk about Bid for Spots. And and to help American business to succeed and to help the radio stations monetize their fantastic programming.
Great. And how long have you been doing this now?
We've been doing it almost 8 years.
Wow. So you know what you're doing at this point.
We're very fortunate. We have about 3,300 radio stations across the country who participate in this, and we've had over 10,000 companies sign up on our site.
Nice. And now the bidding is pretty automated, right? I mean, it's not like you have to actually have like middlemen to handle the bidding itself?
No, the bidding is not automated.
It's not?
No.
Okay.
In fact, that's one of the things I'm most proud of, is that there are no robots or any kind of programmed bidding or anything like that. These are actual sales managers across the country on 3,300 or so stations who are basically killing each other for the advertisers' money live.
Wow.
And
right.
It's a live auction that begins at 8 a.m. In Pacific time, and it ends at noon. And believe me, the servers are white hot near the end of that auction. And the cool thing for advertisers is that they don't do anything. They're basically sitting back because they did their thing the day before by putting in their money, their spot, and their invitation.
Right.
And this is all the work is done by the stations.
Awesome.
Wow.
Well, thank you so much again, Dave. Very interesting. All the best to you with the company.
Thank you, Sam.
And
thank you.
Mia, thank you.
Sounds good. See you tomorrow.
And see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Sam in the Morning with Mia, which airs every Monday through Friday from 10 to 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. If you have a question for the show, or if you'd like to inquire about sponsorship opportunities, please send an email along to sam@latalkradio.com. Sam in the Morning with Mia is a production of LA Talk Radio, where we say what we want.